Vous écoutez en balado-diffusion le colloque Civic Freedom in an Age of Diversity, James Tully's Public Philosophy, présenté par le groupe de recherche sur les sociétés plurinationales. 17e épisode, conférence d'Alain G. Gagnon, Competing Conceptions of Quebec as a Political Community.
Bonjour tout le monde. Thank you very much for being there. It's very appreciated, and obviously this is a moment that I want to celebrate with all of you, in the sense that it's not every day that James Tully is at UQAM. It's not every day that is in Montreal and in Quebec, and we definitely like to bring him back here for the long duration at one point. Let me say, my first encounter with Jim goes back to the late 1980s. This was the moment of high tension between Quebec and the rest of Canada, in particular with respect to the Meech Lake and Charlottetown. And I was tempted, after 13 years of spending my life in English Canada, to return to Quebec. And there was an opening. Daniel Latouche had left McGill. Daniel was one of the most outspoken on Quebec issue at McGill, and he was never able to get to the full professorship after 17 years of a very productive time. So I said, do I go there? And my colleague at Carleton University was saying, no, it's a mistake. Don't ever go to McGill. I mean, you will find no one to work with there. I said, well, I'm not sure. I think I'd like to return to, quote unquote, my homeland. And I think there's a lot of people there that I can work with. I said, I think there are four reasons why I want to be at McGill. The first one is Charles Taylor. Charles Taylor has a lot to bring to the country. He is able to enter into discussion, exchanges. There's also James Tully, who is there, open, diverse in his mind, plural, defending minority groups and nations and so on. There are also people in the law department I think I can work with. There's Rod MacDonald there, very prestigious, strong, open, generous with respect to Quebec, Quebec identity and Quebec's future. And there was also Nicolas Cassirer and Jeremy Weber. So in fact, I didn't have four reasons, I had five reasons to come to Montreal. And as I move forward, I think this was the best decision I've ever made. Of course, I took my distance from the research I used to do. I used to work on regional development, uneven development, the eastern Quebec area, the remote areas, the periphery, so to speak, fighting against internal colonialism in many ways. And then I shifted my interest toward constitutional politics. Now, obviously, people at McGill, when they hired me, they didn't hire me for constitutional politics or Quebec nationalism or Quebec issue or dealing with multinational societies. I mean, this is not how they view me. They view me as the guy that was not corrupted, that had been trained in English Canada at Simon Fraser, who had been trained at Carleton University to get his PhD, and then went on to teach at Queen's University in Carleton and so on. So this was the perfect guy to teach at McGill. Now, obviously, it didn't happen to be exactly the case. So the more I stay there, the more they feel, well, this guy is really a troublemaker. And he's always raising issues about Quebec nation, Quebec identity, multinational federalism, Aboriginal rights, and so on and so forth. And as we move in the 1990s, we develop a lot of research projects, one of which was to think the Quebec nation, for instance, which was a very, very powerful experience that I had at McGill. But this was, in fact, inspired by Jim in many ways, in a way that he conceived the community. And then we held a conference at McGill in the four national languages, in Cree, in Okotok, French, and English, to the great surprise of my university principal, who felt that we could not ever achieve that, and that French was not to be spoken too frequently. So that being said, we then move forward and had another conference in North Attleigh on multinational democracy. And this is where I think we came together as a community. The JRSP came together, developed a major project on that front, and Jim was definitely the key man in organizing this event and in developing the project in the long duration. So today, obviously, my challenge is not to tell you all of that story, but I think this sort of situates the connection, it situates our relationship and the trust that has been developed between the two of us and between the member of our community group. Now, let me then move into the silent case. The silent case in this conference has been Quebec. We didn't speak very much about Quebec, let's be fair about it. There was some very keen, interesting remark with respect to the Charter of Values, undermining, in a sense, the Quebec position with respect to other cases, and we were very discreet not to speak on the Quebec Nation. So what I want today here to do here is to look at, with some what I call Quebec lenses, and try to examine the contribution of Jim in the long duration with respect to that very specific case. So Jim has always insisted on the idea that Canadian federalism consisted in an ongoing negotiation in order to work out, and this is his word, the middle ground position, that are respectful of competing visions and history through a process of continued interaction stretching from the 1645 Haudenosaunee Treaty to the present time. This position rests on a moral ground and is probably impossible to seriously challenge in normative terms. However, and this connects with what Herder was saying, in real politics, the situation appears to be different, as well remembered by Schatz Schneider, who says that in the case of politics, the definition of alternative is the supreme instrument of power. The antagonist can rarely agree on what the issues are because power is involved in the definition. He who determines what politics is all about runs the country, because the definition of the alternative is the choice of conflict, and the choice of conflict allocates power, end of quote. From a Quebec point of view, two dominant visions have occupied the center field in Canadian politics since Confederation. On the one hand, we find advocates of a monochrome Canada that insists on building an all-encompassing state, Johnny Macdonald, Frank Underhill, Pierre Trudeau, Michael Bliss, Jack Granatstein. This is well rendered by Jim's perceptive statement made in Strange Multiplicity that, and I quote, the suppression of cultural difference in the name of uniformity and unity is one of the leading causes of civil strife, disunity, and dissolution today, end of quote. And on the other end, the other school, we have proponent of a distinct, potentially separate Quebec that could eventually make its entrance into the Council of Nations. Honoré Mercier, René Lévesque, Claude Ryan, Gérard Bouchard, Michel Seymour are the advocates of similar position. Between these two political projects, we find political leaders and public intellectuals that have elaborated many possible scenarios, among which, and I name four here, finding a proper balance between centralization and decentralization, here resonate the name of Richard Simeon. Advancing the notion of asymmetry as a potent instrument to reduce political tensions, Jeremy Weber. Maintaining and developing a Canadian conversation through the advancement of a creative politics, Charles Taylor. Or else building a political philosophy grounded on an ongoing dialogue that opposes any form of imperialism and domination, Jim. Indeed, this is where Jim's work takes its full meaning. This is a situation in which all people involved in the negotiation process bring with them their set of values or meaning systems and are willing to consider new political orientation and precepts in light of the discussion that is generated by all parties involved in those exchanges. My purpose here is not to deconstruct everyone's argument, but rather to appraise the extent to which Jim's singular account allows for redressal of unfair practices and elaboration of a public philosophy that is sound and that could be transplanted elsewhere in the world. Jim has set very high standards through his own defense of public philosophy and civic freedom as effective ways to question democratic practices at all levels, locally, nationally, and globally, as Melissa Williams pointed out yesterday. He continues to be a world leader in demanding that position emanating from the weakest groups, communities, nations be expressed, heard, and considered by people in position of authority and domination. In this presentation, I have asked myself to what extent Jim's pioneering work in the area of ancient and modern constitutional politics has received a fair hearing and has been adopted or silenced by political elites. Tully is of the view that we need to adopt what he calls a position based on groundless trust that will, it is presumed, be transformed in the medium or long term as grounded trust. As partners gradually become aware of their respective preferences and claims through processes of revealing oneself or in the process of contesting perceived unfair relations of power. Tully's take on this issue contrasts sharply with the one adopted by the by the adept of a Kantian school that argues that for a relation to be positively constructed, we must first settle on a set of norms that would be recognized and agreed upon by everyone involved in the seek after political arrangement. In other words, Tully is not of the view that we should leave out our culture, identities, and meaning system at the door when entering into the negotiation process. And I think this is a very important element. However, we ought to be aware that Tully's efforts at regaining the middle moral ground might not be of much comfort when a dominant group decides to impose its authority on national minorities, as is currently the case in Catalonia, where the central state denies the Generalitat the simple right to consult its population through a consultative referendum. My intention here is not to demonstrate that Jim has always been consistent with his philosophical position, but to appraise the extent to which his stand in favor of an agonist position can deliver the necessary element to build a just democracy while contributing to the political stability of a given political regime. Through this account, I wish to express a healthy skepticism, as Jim always invites us to do, and raise some question about the real nature of power in Canada. In this presentation, then, and building on Jim's insights, I focus on two key moments in the Quebec-Canada's political dynamics, namely the new constitutional order of 1982 and the reference case of 1998 with respect to the right of Quebec to secede, and identify what I viewed as preconditions for a fair negotiation between constitutional partners. The Constitutional Act of 1982 was generally being considered in Quebec as a denial that there is anything constitutionally significant concerning the idea that Quebec is forming a distinct society or a nation. This lack of recognition has contributed to feed mistrust between the two principal majorities in the country. As a result, the content of that imposed accord on Quebec rests on constitutional stand that promote institutional bilingualism in contrast with territorial bilingualism that tends to treat provinces similarly by undermining asymmetrical federalism that feeds multiculturalism at the expense of interculturalism and that advances a pan-Canadian constitutional patriotism, to use Sujit Chaudhry's notion, at the expense of other forms of political belonging. It is worth pointing out that these four components are at present entrenched in the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedom, which was added by the central government and the nine Anglophone provinces, despite the clearly expressed opposition of Quebec National Assembly to the new constitutional accord of 1982. Tully is among the philosophers who has most closely analyzed the impact of the Charter and the 1982 imposed constitutional package on Quebec, and who has debated openly expressions of mistrust and distrust between political communities. Here is what Jim concluded in March 1995, a few months before the holding of the National Assembly, by the National Assembly, of a third referendum on Quebec constitutional future. I quote, "When the National Assembly seeks to preserve and enhance Quebec character as a modern, predominantly French-speaking society, it finds that its traditional sovereignty in this area is capped by a charter in terms of which all its legislation must be phrased and justified, but for whom which any recognition of Quebec's distinct character has been completely excluded. The effect of the charter is thus to assimilate Quebec to a pan-Canadian national culture, exactly what the 1867 Constitution, according to Lord Watson, was designed to prevent." End of quote. What this reveals is not so much that Canada continued to build its own national project, this is clearly an express intention and continuing endeavor, but what it appears to lack is the necessary flexibility to recognize, accommodate, and empower Quebec, and for this matter, First Nation, as we heard last night, in his presentation, as national community evolving within the context of a multinational federation. Canada, through its institution, has always been very shy to take positive steps in that direction. This is not due to the lack of opportunities to consider this option. It is perhaps due to a lack of vision. And this is where Tully's public philosophy in a new key is so important in establishing and forging relation of conditional trust in contrast with blind trust that is too often demanded from the minority groups. According to the dualist theory that has dominated Canada's constitutional negotiation between 1960 to 1980, Quebec constitute a nation in its own right and not and have ought not to have its constitutional status determined by the unilateral will of an all-encompassing Canadian stat folk. This argument was made with force in the objection to by Quebec to the resolution to amend the Constitution in 1982. At the time of the pre-patriation, though, the Supreme Court decided to resolve the dispute by sidestepping the fact that Quebec is a founding member of the country and gave little weight to Quebec distinct status by doing so. And according to Tully, in some of his other writing, the court had imposed a straitjacket on Quebec's right to internal self-determination and did nothing to advance a vision of Canada as a multinational federal country. The reference case here changes the done in a very particular way with respect to Quebec's right to secession, and this contributed to correct some, I would say, a constitutional erring on the part of the Supreme Court, and contributed also to restore, in part, the trust that ought to exist between constitutional partners. And we heard some of this being referred to by Stephen Tierney a bit earlier on. The reference case of 1998 regarding Quebec's right to secede contributed to redeem in good part the Supreme Court's legitimacy in the minds of many Quebecers, and among those people, and represented the first corrective attempt aimed at repairing the 1982 patriation. The Supreme Court specified that in the reference case that even though Quebec never endorsed patriation and denounced the weakening of its political power, it is bound to the terms of the Constitution. What was Jim's position on this very important constitutional moment? Initially, as I mentioned earlier, Jim felt that the court imposed a straitjacket on Quebec constitutional right. Quebec was not free within the Canadian constitutional order for three main reasons, Jim mentioned. First of all, the other member of the Federation can impose constitutional amendment on it without its consent. They can also arbitrarily block any constitutional amendment designed to give Quebec the constitutional status of nation. Second, the content of the amending formula introduced in 1982 entails that it is virtually impossible in practice to amend the Constitution in such a way that Quebec is recognized as a nation. And third, the court holds that the phase two of the negotiation triggered by a clear majority in a referendum on a clear question should be governed by the present amending formula. Yet, owing to the first reason I mentioned above, Quebec is not bound by the amending formula, end of quote. Jim judged then the situation in which Quebec found itself in 1999 to be completely unacceptable, unfair, and detrimental to the well-being of the country. In the following year, at the conference Jim pronounced at the Quebec Studies Program at McGill, which I used to lead, Jim had changed his stand, and I will try to illustrate how in a second. And here I have to skip because there is a time that sort of is going too fast. In his 2000 lecture at McGill entitled The Unattained Yet Attainable Democracy, Canada and Quebec Face the New Century, Jim changed the general understanding of the 1982 patriation by returning to the living tree metaphor and arguing that Canada's constitutional order ought to be perceived as flexible and continuous process of reconciling diversity with unity, among other problems, by means of negotiation in accordance with the appropriate written and unwritten constitutional principle, end of quote. This revised position suggests that Jim's own position is softer than Claude Ryan's takes on the constitutional issue at the time, and I bring Ryan in my paper, but I will not refer to him more directly here. In a forthcoming book by Guy Laforêt, Laforêt makes the point that Jim becomes less and less sensitive to the fact that Quebec did not endorse the patriation package and that he aligns himself too much now with the winners. Contrary to the 1999 text in his McGill conference, according to Laforêt, Tully now, and I quote, subscribe with enthusiasm to the court's idea that the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedom is not a straitjacket for Quebec. Tully considered that we can skip over the fact that Quebec did not consent to the Charter and that the text does not recognize a fundamental aspect of its diversity, namely its identity and distinct society. With respect to the first issue, Tully notes that the court defended the ideal of legal continuity and recognized in its decision at the time the concept of a qualified majority without overlooking the fact that Quebec representative in the federal parliament did indeed, by a large majority, give the consent to the charter. I know the time is flying. By changing the, and I'm sure people are going to allow me 2 minutes more. By changing his stand on the 1982 Petition, Tully gives Ottawa the upper hand with respect to the new constitutional order and seems to take some distance from his continued defense of minority nations. In the following section, I'm building on the demos enabling and demos constraining. At the time Jim published his text, Alfred Stepan published a major text called, in fact, dealing with the demos enabling and the demos constraining. From a Quebec perspective, the Canadian Federation has generally been viewed as demos constraining, while attempts at reforming the Constitution and referendum have been presented as demos enabling by minority nations. Now, I sort of developed this argument the more I move forward, and as I said, the multinational setting in this case is obviously an agonic game, but this agonic game seems to favor the winner. And this is the problem I find in the current debate with respect to Jim's political contribution and philosophical contribution. Now, I conclude with some of the work I've done on minority nation in this age of diversity. And I'm trying there in my own work to indicate the extent to which we can build a new relationship based on four dimensions, and those will be my four last points. One is that we need to search for a balance with respect to conflict in claims and values. We need to find a proper equilibrium on these two types of claims, that of two conflicts that are made. There are conflicts of claims that are made, and there are conflicts of value. Second one is that there is a quest for dignity for individual and nation alike, and those have to be taken extremely seriously. Third is an expression of, I would call it, hospitality toward others that we should focus much more on. And in Quebec here, the Charter of Values there was not an expression of that. And this has to be, this was condemnable from my position. So I should add that these three components are essential in trying to make a better society, in trying to make sure that winners are in fact present, but that there is grounded behind that there is some constitutional morality, and this you can't escape. Thank you very much.